This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Petrol prices have soared across the nation, and it hurts the hip pocket when it comes time to fill up, especially in areas where costs are heading towards $2 a litre, and in some rural, remote, regional areas, it's already well past that. Central to the price of petrol in Australia is the price that petrol is selling for overseas. The price of crude oil is around, what, $85 to $90 a barrel. Talk is that it may well be over $100 a barrel pretty soon, and we last saw that around 2014. And that will really make things worse. Donald Trump tightened sanctions on Iran. That's one of the reasons, perhaps, that the price of a barrel of oil has been rising. But how are our prices determined here, and why do they fluctuate? What is the so-called price cycle of petrol? At the moment, Queensland and the ACT spend the most on fuel at the pump, and many truckies listening to us know full well how the price of diesel is hurting as well. It's frustrating for everybody. To tell us more about oil prices, petrol prices, why we no longer refine our own petroleum here, how the system works, our guest is Mark McKenzie of the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Rod.
Is this the worst it has been, do you think, the price of petrol?
No. We hit a peak, a lot of your listeners will remember, sort of around the late 2006, early 2007, when we got into prices that were plumbing, you know, close to $1.80, $1.85 at the top. We're getting very close to that, though. And as you've opened up there, we've got a whole range of factors that, at least in the short term, suggest that we're not likely to see it turn down soon.
So why did it go up to $1.80 or so a litre in 2006-07?
Well, it was a similar sort of issue. So in 2006-07, we had a lot of demand. You might remember we had a real strengthening of the global economy, and so you got a demand for a commodity, which made it scarce. That pushed prices up, and we saw oil prices get, as a lot of people have sort of suggested, around the $1.20, $1.30, $120, $130 US a barrel. We had a good exchange rate at that time, though, which sort of protected us a little bit from those sorts of rises.
When did it start becoming a commodity? Because this is an essential. It should not be bought and sold so that other people can make money. It should just be sold to the manufacturers, who drill the oil, refine it, and sell it to the petrol stations.
I think it's always been a commodity. I think the issue for us, obviously, is that we see it as an essential, and it is, for any modern economy that uses transport to move goods and services and people around. It's a key essential service because it's linked to our financial, social and economic well-being. But the reality here is that what's happened over the last, probably over the last 40 or 50 years, and you highlighted in your opening that, we've seen less refining in our country, we've become more exposed to a couple of big global economies that are effectively, they have an oligopoly on oil, so it's concentrated in a few large countries these days, and they throttle the price to get the best they can out of their natural resource, just as we try to do with things like steel and copper and iron ore.
So, it was also thought a couple of years ago that the price of oil was being kept artificially down because those the countries that drill oil and then distribute it wanted people to use oil rather than, say, natural gas and things like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. I think the other thing that was running at the time, there was a thing called shale oil. So where you're actually you're effectively making oil out of stone, so you're crushing an oil-rich shale. And because the oil prices were actually quite high, while that process was fairly expensive, the high oil prices were changing the market dynamics so that people who produce shale oil were able to get into the market. And so what the oil producers got together was to say, well, gee, if we stay that high, we're going to have more competitors, so let's bring the price down a little bit. And it meant that those high producers couldn't continue to supply the market. It was just uneconomic for them to do so.
I've got a couple of calls we'll get to quickly who've got some questions about prices right at the very end of the supply chain. Eric, good morning.
Morning, Rod and Mark. Yeah, I'd like to correct you on a couple of things, if I may.
No, just get to your question if you can, Eric.
Well, I think one reason with prices are high in Australia is we've lost a lot of competition amongst petrol. You know, we used to have Golden Fleece, Ampol, Esso, Fina, Total and some others. There were a lot less competition. They could put the price up too, you know. And,
okay.
And I believe we do still refine oil at Geelong and Altona and Kwinana, okay, south enough. Of Perth, and Sydney, there's still a refinery, I think, doing it.
All
and
right.
we get 9% of our own oil. We import 91%.
Yeah. All right, Eric. I appreciate that. And Jeff also. Good morning, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning, Rod. I was just listening to that.
Mark McKenzie's our guest, yep.
Yep. Now, I was just listening. If people banded together and boycotted one of the multinational companies for a week, they would have no choice but drop the price of their fuel and the others have to follow suit. Then you boycott another one of the buggers. You know, we've got, the people have the power to drop the price of fuel. We have it. All we have to do is stick together and
how would you organise that, Jeff?
Well, there's a thing on Facebook at the moment with a national fuel thing, end of the month, 30, 27, 28, 29, whatever. Nobody buys petrol. One day will not make a difference. One day won't matter. They don't care. Yeah. It's we're being taxed on the fuel, what's it, roughly half? So on the average GST and so forth in. You know. But
that's all right. I'll get Mark to comment on that. Thank you, Jeff. Okay, so Eric says there should be more competition with more brands of service stations. Mark, what do you make of that?
Yeah, so historically we had about 26,000 service stations in 1978. We fell down to about 6,400, progressively declined over that time through to a low in 2008. And our service stations have climbed slowly now to about 7,300. Like all industries, we've actually seen a consolidation. So we've had less service stations and they've got bigger and they needed to do that in terms of the economics. We do have very healthy competition. So, and I know that always sounds like a bit of a catch cry from industry, but what a lot of people forget, while you tend to see six or seven main brands, the big refiners and the big companies, and sort of getting on to the question that Jeff's just asked, they own only about a third of the service stations and operate them. The rest are actually operated by small business who have branding arrangements where they look and feel like a big service station because they've got the brand, but effectively they're setting their own price and they're competing with each other. And that leads to the petrol cycle, which we'll probably get onto a little later. So within that context, competition's actually pretty fierce. And Rod Sims in the ACCC released a report not that long ago now that says, you know, we've got pretty healthy competition where the three main groups, that is the big marketers, the big companies that Jeff has just been touched on, operate about a third of the service stations and control the price of a third of the market. Supermarkets control a third. And then all the independent businesses operate control about a third. And that's pretty healthy given the small population that we've actually got relative to global markets.
All right. Now, what about what Jeff was saying? If we all decide not to buy petrol from a particular brand, would that make any difference? Would that drop prices? And really, how sustainable is that in the long run?
Well, I suppose the issue is it may. It would have to be very effective and be, you know, right across the country. But let me just say here that it's important to understand the cost build-up. So the product cost, which is something that no one can control, it effectively comes from the oil-producing countries, the cost of oil, as well as the exchange rate, represents about 48% of the current price. Government taxes, that's excise and GST, represent about 35%. And then you've got wholesale costs, which are costs controlled by individual marketers, which is about 10%. And then the retail costs, that's the cost of Australian businesses here in terms of selling the fuel, is about 7%. So if you go on that basis, the biggest influence that you can potentially have with something like that is about 17% of the total price. But within that context, you know, we're talking about those percentages are both costs and profit. You know, there's been a fair bit of talk about, well, let's just boycott one particular supplier. The reality here is that's unlikely to have much effect because most of the factors that control the price are actually offshore.
Okay. John wants to ask a specific question about something. G'day, John.
G'day, Rod. Look, first, Chief, you must be one of the few people who know anything about this in the country, I reckon, and so I hope I learned something. But I'm just wondering, I've heard that we've got approximately, if I remember correctly, 6 weeks petrol supply on the mainland Australia at any one time at maximum. But I'm also wondering, do we have any reserves we can develop, and how do we compare with Norway and what they do with the amount of money they get for their country?
All right, thanks very much, John. So the Department of the Environment and Energy shows, and I think they release these statistics every month, Australia has 21 days of petrol stock, 16 days of diesel, 19 days of aviation fuel. Is that enough, Mark?
Well, it depends who you talk to. So Australia is a signatory to something called the International Energy Agency Agreement, which is a UN agreement that says that all economies would keep a 90-day stockholding. Now, this is something that was historic. It occurred in the late 70s, where a lot of the European economies were dependent on a single pipeline coming out of Russia. And the theory was that if an economy ran out of oil, then its capacity to sell products and to buy products would be diminished, and it would affect other economies. So a whole series of countries entered into an agreement that said we'll have a 90-day stockholding. Now, that 90 days is equivalent to what you import. Australia, as has rightly been said, you know, the numbers vary a little bit depending upon whether you talk about what's actually on land versus what's on its way on water. But we're significantly below, it's about 40 days, significantly below the 90-day goal. But I suppose the big issue here is as long as you've got a continuous chain and as long as you've got multiple sources coming into the country, then you're not as vulnerable as, say, the scenario in the 70s where you had a single pipeline where Russia could have turned off the supply of oil. And in Australia at the moment, we've got about 25 or 26 different pathways, that is, different sources of oil coming into the country at any one time. So we've not had a supply interruption for, you know, a serious one for the better part of about 30 years now, and a large part of that's been that we've diversified our supply. So on the one hand, we're certainly below the 90-day target, and that's something that's been keeping the government and the industry busy over the last couple of years. But on the other hand, we've now got multiple supplies, and that's given us a degree of protection.
Okay. Mark McKenzie is our guest this morning as we talk about petrol price, supply, demand. Shane wants to ask something, and I'll ask something off the back of that. Shane, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Rod. Thanks for taking my call.
That's all right. What would you like to ask?
G'day, Mark. How are you going?
Good, Shane.
Yeah, look, I've got a report here, and it's from The Conversation. It says Australia refinery imports roughly 83% of the crude oil it processed from more than 17 countries, mainly in Asia, 40%, but also Africa, 18%, the Middle East, 17%. But we are a significant oil producer, but it seems like there's a foreign corporation exporting 75% of our crude production to other countries, mainly Indonesia and Singapore. And I find it strange that we import, and they say by 2030, if you can confirm this, by 2030 we'll be totally reliant on foreign imports. That'll be great for the foreign corporations to put us in more debt. But I just find it bizarre, and you probably do too, 75% of our crude, and we do produce a lot of oil here, goes over to Indonesia and Singapore while we go into huge debt.
All right, Shane. Okay, so that is something I wanted to ask as well. If we decided not to import any oil and just use that we produce ourselves, that's about 9% at the moment, and we import 91%. Shane says we're exporting 75% of what we produce. Would we be able to cover the amount that we need with our own production, and how long would that last?
That's a very complex question, so let me break it down a little bit. All crude isn't the same. We have what we call both sweet and sour crude, and that depends upon the various compositions of the crudes that are actually coming out. So oil refineries are geared up for one of the particular crudes that are optimised around the type of material that's actually coming out of the ground. In Australia, what we tend to do here is that we used to have 7 refineries. We're now down to 4, and one of your callers had correctly identified where they were. So we've got 2 in Victoria, 1 at Altona, 1 at Geelong. We've got 1 left in Brisbane at Lytton, and we've got 1 in Kwinana in WA. The others have actually closed down, so there is no refinery anymore in Sydney. It's a terminal that's actually there. So what basically happens is it's a case of making sure that there is a level of fit between what the refinery is geared for and the sort of crude that it actually needs to take. Our refineries are fairly old, so in terms of unit cost of production, they're fairly small by global standards. And they tend to be geared really for the sort of crude that was actually coming out of the Bass Strait. What's been happening over time now is a lot of the crude that's coming out of the ground is coming out from the Northwest Shelf, so it's actually much closer to Asian refineries. And they're coming out of refineries now, our fuel products coming out of refineries that are mega compared to our market. So there are refineries in South America now that are six times, their production is six times higher than all of our refinery production together. So while it doesn't make a lot of sense when you first look at it to say, well, why are we sending the crude overseas and buying it back? The costs of production now for our refineries is getting to a point where they're fairly old, they're fairly small in global terms, so they're fairly expensive in terms of the finished product that comes out, that it's actually better for us in a lot of circumstances to actually buy finished product from these global refineries that have a cheaper cost of production.
Okay.
But as your caller's identified here, that's increased our exposure then to the global market and exchange rate movements. And that means we get into a situation that becomes to a point where we outsource some of our risk in terms of the cost of fuel.
So if we did decide, though, to refine or build a much bigger refinery, perhaps in the North West Shelf, and only sell to Australia rather than anywhere else, how long do you think we'd be able to produce our own fuel for? What kind of reserves we have there?
We don't really, I suppose, because you're still at a point here where there are reserves that we're discovering all the time, particularly as we start to do more and more exploration in relation to natural gas, because a lot of oil condensate sits there with natural gas in the ground. So there's not an easy answer to that question, but I suppose the key challenges we've got at the moment in relation to oil are not due to us running out of oil. They're basically due to the fact that the market's been throttled by those people who actually own the oil asset. The other thing at play is that vehicles are becoming more fuel efficient. So here in Australia, for the first time in 90 years, the amount of motor spirit, that is petrol, that we consume has been falling and has started to slightly decline as more and more of the fleet has become more efficient.
Mark McKenzie is our guest from the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. Ivan says, so the government is also saying it's cheaper to export and pay a debt than use our own and pay wages, basically.
The answer is yes to that, because really when you get to a point here of looking at the cost of production, that's quite significant. Our energy costs, our wages costs, and our rent, plus the fact that we've got fairly small refineries on a world scale, mean that, yes, it is actually cheaper because you're moving large amounts of oil. So even though it sounds a bit odd, because of the huge numbers and huge volumes that are actually involved, it is actually cheaper for us to source it elsewhere at the moment.
Paper Chucker says, most of the petrol is supplied by Caltex no matter what station you fill up from. Is that right?
That's the case in New South Wales, but it's not the case in other states. So typically where you've got a refinery that is actually run by one of the bigger marketers, you'll actually find that they've developed a historical market share that is bigger than most of the other competitors. But it has been changing for some time. So in New South Wales, about 50% of the fuel that's coming in is actually coming in through the Caltex channel.
Okay. What about what Donald Trump did with sanctions on Iran? How did that affect things?
Right, so this is what's actually driving up the prices, as you've highlighted in your introduction. So we've got a series of geopolitical factors, so, you know, politics and security, that are actually leading to market analysts repricing crude. So what Donald Trump's actually done in terms of Iran is to cease demand from that country, which means he's now trying to source it from other countries. So as a result, what happens is the competition for the crude that's coming from countries other than Iran is intensifying. And as you get a competition demand that increases, obviously the bidding war goes up and the cost of fuel gets more expensive. But while a lot of people have talked about Iran, there's a whole series of other things going on. global production is very tight. So in terms of supply and demand, it's kept very tight to make sure that those who are producing the oil are getting the best price they can get, because that's what their economies are seeking to do. We've also got problems in Venezuela. It produces about 10% of global oil products into the world markets. And unfortunately, that country's going through some significant internal problems in terms of political unrest. And their production's been halved as a result of that. So we've got almost a perfect storm, where we've got the issues where OPEC itself, the oil-producing countries, have decided that they're going to hold back a bit of demand to increase the price. We've got sanctions coming from the US that actually mean the US is competing for other forms of fuel other than that coming from Iran. And then we've got political unrest in countries like Venezuela that are actually driving up demand as well. So all these things are pushing fuel price up.
Why do you think it is that oil seems to come from politically unstable countries? Is it because they have oil that makes them unstable, because it's such an in-demand commodity?
That's an interesting question, Rod. I've never really thought of it that way. I suppose, look, it's really just a case that a lot of the countries that are actually emerging, you know, we have oil stocks that effectively has come about as a result of, I suppose, what you call geophysical issues. So certain parts of the world tend to have significant oil stocks, and a lot of those are developing economies or economies that have sort of just gone into the developed world. And as a result, those economies tend to be ones where the political systems aren't as mature as perhaps they are elsewhere. The fact that the Middle East actually has large stocks, traditionally, that's always been an area of unrest. And, you know, for whatever reason, they've ended up with those stocks, just in terms of the way that the world was formed. And the reality here is that means we've been exposed to those economies.
What a shame. 1-300-800-222. Ian from Marino says, if we unilaterally went from litres to gallons, would the punters cop $8 a gallon?
Well, I suppose that's a question for your listeners, but I mean, that's effectively what we're paying now, but people buy it on a litre basis, you'd just be buying less of the gallon. So, you know, you're still paying the same amount here. And I suppose the key point to come back to is the point I made earlier. Our vehicles have become more fuel efficient. So while the unit price is actually going up, you know, the average fuel volume used to be for passenger cars used to be about 54 litres. It's now come down to about 52. Now, that's right across the country. But if you think about your standard family sedan that you used to buy, about 10 years ago, that vehicle was consuming about 11 to 12 litres per 100 kilometres. Today, the same vehicle, I'm not talking about hybrids, but just in terms of fuel efficiency, will be consuming about 8 to 9 litres per 100 kilometres.
Okay.
And if you go with a hybrid, just a mild hybrid, then that fuel consumption comes down to about 6 litres per 100 kilometres. So what's happening for some people is, as they're buying new and more fuel-efficient cars, their total fuel consumption is effectively coming down. So even though the unit price is going up, in terms of the total household expenditure, quite apart from the increases we've seen in recent times, are staying fairly flat. And we're feeling that as an industry in terms of total volume of sales.
Okay. We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you, Mark. I'll ask one more question, which you kind of addressed briefly a moment ago, but I'll ask it anyway. Of the $1.80 for fuel, how much of this is tax? So what percentage of what we pay at the bowser is actually tax?
Okay, so at the price we are at the moment, 40.9 cents is what we call fuel excise.
Okay.
So this figure is indexed twice a year. The government changes it in February and August. It actually increases it according to CPI. So it goes up slowly. And in the last increase, which was in August, it went up by 0.3 of a cent. So it went from 40.6 to 40.9. And then we pay GST. And the GST obviously varies according to what the price is actually doing.
I want to get to that in a moment. In fact, right now, Jeremy's got a question about that. Hello, Jeremy.
Yeah, good morning, guys. A very interesting discussion.
Okay.
Why are we paying GST on the excise? Goods and services tax is goods and services tax. So the excise is neither a good nor a service.
It could be described as a good, but yes, they're not supposed to be taxes on... The GST was not supposed to be imposed on taxes. Why do we pay it, Mark?
Well, that's probably a question for the government. But let me just explain the history. In 2000, when the goods and services tax was actually introduced, the motoring associations did some fairly good work and said, well, look, we shouldn't be seeing a tax on a tax. An excise was actually excluded from the GST calculation, so it was just done on the good itself. The government changed that process a few years back. I can't remember the exact date, but I think it was about 2008, where, in fact, they said, no, it's better if we just work on the basis of the total retail price or the total wholesale price. So remember, GST is collected at various points in the chain. It's collected when the wholesaler actually buys the fuel in the country, and then there is GST collected when the retailer buys fuel from the wholesaler. And I'd agree. I think there is an issue here that there is a simple principle here that says it is a tax on a tax. But unfortunately, that's the decision that the government's made in recent years, and we pay that.
All right. Let's get to some calls. George, good morning.
Good morning, Rod. Good morning, Mark. Yeah, Mark's kind of touched on a few of the geopolitical factors I was interested in getting answers to. But I just wanted to ask Mark about sort of the long-term projections that maybe his organisation has and other oil companies in Australia might have gone in terms of when will kind of peak demand, worldwide demand, occur if they've done any projections. Obviously, places like India and China, obviously a lot of the middle class is booming and they all want cars, and that will make a huge difference in the price. And also in terms of long-term projections of things like electric or hybrid cars, which will obviously change the equation from the demand side in the long term. So I'm just wondering if any of those projections have been done, how accurate they are and what they are.
Beautiful. Thanks, George. Okay, Mark.
Okay, the simple answer to this question is, look, on the basis of current known supply, so we're still discovering oil around the world, and that's the key point to note here. But in terms of what we know is now in the ground, in terms of what we've discovered and using, we've got somewhere in the order of 35 to 40 years of supply globally, and that assumes that countries like China and India continue to come online. Now, if we'd had this conversation right about 20 years ago, there were a whole lot of people predicting that we were going to hit peak oil around 2006. But we've seen a whole range of factors influence that. The fact that we've discovered supply we didn't think we would. And in addition, we've actually seen the global fleet become more fuel efficient. So we're seeing significant reductions in the consumption of new vehicles. I talked earlier about the fact that vehicles have become more fuel efficient. There is a vehicle that you can buy in the Australian market today. I won't name it, but it's a family wagon that effectively is a smart hybrid. So effectively it has an electric motor, and then it has a petrol engine that is a very small engine that replaces the batteries. So it's an onboard generator that just charges a small bank of batteries, which means you don't have to plug it in. But effectively the vehicle is driven by an electric motor. And it does 1.9 litres per 100 kilometres.
So who's holding back the electric car?
Well, nobody really. I think the key thing with the electric car is that most of the economists and the automotive makers have worked out at the moment that because of the cost of batteries and battery materials, a typical battery pack, so if you put a battery pack on wheels, today it costs $25,000 before you've done anything with the car. So we did some work about 4 months ago that actually said, look, for someone who wanted to buy one of the cheapest electric vehicles available on the market at the moment, it's about a $15,000 increase in cost over an equivalent petrol vehicle, which would mean that at a price of $1.80, it's going to take you 8.5 years to just recover that additional capital cost. So the key thing here is that automotive manufacturers are slowly introducing electrification in hybrids. And over time, as we start to see the costs of electric vehicles come down, you should start to see more fully electric vehicles start to appear in the market. In other countries, particularly some of the European countries, governments have actually mandated sales of electric vehicles, and they've created incentives, and that's induced demand.
Well, if someone can produce an electric car for under $20,000, they won't be able to... sell enough of them. They'd be selling.
Yes,
everyone would be. Trevor, good morning, Trev.
Yeah, g'day, Rod. How are you?
Good, mate.
I do a 700-kilometre trip in my truck 3 nights a week.
Yep.
And every Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday nights, I'm on the road now. I want to know why the little service station in Great Western Victoria is $1.48.9 7 days a week. It's been like that for the last year.
Right.
And there's two huge green service stations, 70k out of Melbourne, that have been $1.48.9 for as long as I can remember. They never change. And yet, when I left Melbourne last night, it was gone up to $1.68.9. Why the country areas can stay low, but Melbourne goes up every fortnight.
All right. So this is something that everyone wants to know, Mark. Why is it that there is, in some cases, a huge discrepancy between prices? And you might, after addressing that, talk about the so-called price cycle.
Yep. Well, Rod, this you've just highlighted, that's the reason that explains what Trevor's talking about. It is actually the price cycle. And Trevor's probably picked up something for the Victorian listeners or the Melbourne listeners that need to be conscious of. So we have a thing called the petrol price cycle, which only affects capital city prices. It does not affect regional prices. So Trevor had mentioned here he was seeing stations outside of the city that were staying fairly standard. So we have five capital cities, and that's basically Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth, who have a petrol price cycle where we see these swings of highs to lows. And that's really due to the competition dynamic in each of those markets. So we've got a very contestable fuel volume where the fuel retailers have to actually compete for your business. And they do that by getting involved in a game of leapfrog in terms of lowering their price. So we do get to a situation that when the capital city prices are at the top of the cycle, the highest price, they are more expensive than the regional areas. And when they get to the bottom of the cycle, because the regional price stays fairly stable, the capital city price becomes cheaper than the regional areas. Now, in Melbourne, the last high price we had in terms of the top of the cycle was basically on the 26th of September. So that's, what, about 24, 25 days ago. A typical cycle in Melbourne is about 25 to 28 days before it starts to turn up. So Trevor just highlighted there that he's seen a price move. And I think one of the things for all your listeners to be conscious of is the fact that if you're aware of the petrol price cycle, you can generally try and buy before you get the very big increase that actually occurs. And we've seen recently in Brisbane and more recently in Sydney, the price cycles in those cities turn up, and we're expecting that Melbourne will probably shortly follow. But this price cycle has nothing to do with global oil prices. It's got to do with local competition. And what basically happens here is the price goes to a point which would be the desirable price for a business in terms of its costs and profit. And then what happens is all the service stations start to compete with each other. So they get involved in, I'll drop my price by a cent, then you might drop your price by a cent, then Trevor might drop his price by a cent, then I respond. And we keep going down in this game of discounting leapfrog until we get to a point of pain. One of us gets to a point of pain and says, look, I've had enough at this level. I'm losing too much money. I'd be better off selling a smaller volume at a better margin, at a better profit, because I'm losing too much money, and I go up. Now, what happens then is when I go up, there's no point in you staying down low, so you follow me, and then Trevor will follow me. And then so you get a situation where in 4 or 5 days, the price goes up. But the key thing here is when we're selling at the bottom of the cycle, we're selling at a loss. So if I look at Sydney in terms of the cycle that's just finished, it was moving at a level where effectively it started at about 22 cents a litre over my buy price, my wholesale price. So when I discount the fact that it costs me about 9 or 10 cents a litre to sell the fuel, I was making a gross profit of 12 cents per litre. By the time I got to the end of the cycle, so right down the bottom, I was losing 6 cents a litre. So there was a balance over that time that I was averaging about 12 cents a litre. So it's like having a sale. You go to the top.
Yeah.
And I keep having a sale to attract a whole lot of customers, so you come and buy my fuel,
okay,
my chips, chocs, and convenience items. And then I get to a point where this is just a mug's game, and so I go up and everyone follows me.
Right.
it's not 5 or 7 days. It's no longer a weekly cycle. In most capital cities, it's somewhere between 20 and 35 days in duration. Mm. And it's, you can predict it on the basis of what's happened historically. And that's Melbourne's getting to the end of its current cycle.
The high cycle or the low cycle?
So it's getting to the end of, well, it's a total cycle from low to low. So low through high and back again. So we're getting to the point that you would expect that the cycle would end soon, that is the discounting would end soon, and you'll start to see the price potentially move up.
It's hard to believe it's going to get higher, but it will, of course. Daryl, good morning, Daryl.
Morning, how are you?
Good, mate. What would you like to say?
I'm just questioning the barrel price. From memory, a couple of years ago, it was up 120 plus per barrel. Now it's, I think, 80 plus. And yet then we were paying less than $1.20 for diesel. Now we're paying $1.70.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what's happening.
So the Australian dollar obviously has part of that, if the Australian dollar was higher.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point. All right, Mark, what about that?
Yeah, so the competition occurs not just in terms of our global price exposure. It occurs not just in terms of the cost of oil. It also occurs in terms of the cost of finished product. So as we talked about earlier, we're actually buying finished petroleum and finished diesel through the Singapore market, or what we call the Singapore hub. So if there's competition for that product, the two things that affect the price are the price of crude and the competition for that finished product. And both of those are affected by movements in the Australian dollar. And the Australian dollar has dropped by about 10% in the last 13 months, which actually means that even if that the crude price had stayed where it was, we'd be paying 10% more. And so we're getting to a position that those three factors, that is the regional demand, and by regional I mean the Asia-Pacific region for finished product, the global demand for oil, those two are commodity movements, where the prices will be affected by the demand for those products. And then you've obviously got the exchange rate, as you've identified there. So you do get new situations that the oil price provides part of the explanation, but not enough on its own, because the competition also occurs for the finished products.
Okay. Craig is with us. G'day, Craig.
Good morning, Rod. Good morning to your guest, Mark.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call. I've just got a couple of questions I'd like to ask about LP gas.
Yep.
Number one, I want to know, is it true that it's basically a byproduct of refining petrol?
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to know if it's slowly being phased out for retail sale in Australia, because I just seem to think, in my observations, there seems to be less service stations that seem to be stocking it.
All righty, no worries. I remember when everyone was being encouraged to install those LPG tanks in their boot to make it cheaper. So is it a byproduct, Mark?
Yes, it is. So LP gas is something that is a byproduct of the petroleum refining process. So it comes from the four refineries that we've actually got. But the other source of LP gas is when you pull natural gas out of the ground, you actually bring LP gas out of the ground as well. So we've actually got a significant volumes coming out as a result of the production of natural gas and LNG fields around the country. So there's plenty of it available, is the first point to actually highlight. The problem with LP gas, as you call it, quite rightly identified, we've actually seen a decline in the demand for LP gas, or auto gas as we all know it. It's effectively more than halved in the last 6 years. And the reasons for that are due to a whole series of things. The first is that the number of LPG vehicles on the road has dropped dramatically in recent years, and largely with the disappearance of two of the large automotive manufacturers in this country, in Holden and Ford, who used to make dedicated LPG vehicles. We've got no more new LPG vehicles being supplied into the market. So as a result, the demand has dropped off quite markedly. So fuel retailers are sitting at the point now of saying, well, I've got a limited pool of people now that are coming in to buy LPG. Do I keep that Bowser on the service station where I'm getting less and less customers, or do I replace that with something like a diesel pump or another petrol pump so I can actually sell more of that product?
Okay, I just want to go to Jeff, because he's got a question about this as well. Jeff, that basically answers your question, doesn't it? G'day, Jeff.
Yes, it does effectively, but the other thing that comes from this question is why if we look at independence of our own fuels, isn't there some method that the government could actively promote LPG if we've got such good reserves of it?
Yeah, good point. So why aren't they doing that, Mark?
Well, that's been a question we've been asking as an industry for some time, because we had 3,900, almost half of the network that was actually geared up to sell LPG. It's been almost a forgotten product in public policy. So what the government has done is, in 2011, LPG used to be excise free. They put an excise on it. We've seen the automotive manufacturers no longer make these vehicles, so you can still bring them into the country, and there's a couple of people still doing that. And we basically found that the politicians got quite excited about electric vehicles and completely forgotten about an indigenous fuel source in terms of auto gas that we can make available to the markets, and we can use the existing infrastructure that's already in place. So for electric vehicles, I'm going to have to put recharging infrastructure in place. Mm. So we've been saying for an industry for some time, this is a political blind spot, and we really should be looking. It's an opportunity to create some independence of the global market by actually making more and more of our vehicles operate on LP gas. But we had a pretty well, you know, a combination of circumstances in terms of closure of the manufacturers who used to build these vehicles. We've got excise that's actually come in play, and then we've got the service stations that are responding to the drop in the market. But I would say to anyone who's got LPG gas in their vehicles at the moment, we have not made a decision to get rid of it. What you've basically got is just the service station market adapting to the lower demand.
Right.
And we as an industry, there's an app you can get online, Auto Gas Near Me, that is designed to help people understand where the closest LPG station is for them.
All right. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to get to David and Dave. David in Tasmania first. David, you got a question for us?
Yeah, how much petrol and diesel come out of a barrel of oil?
Good question. How many litres do you get out of a barrel?
I probably should know that one, but I can't tell you offhand.
So if there's 44 gallon drums, you just convert them to litres.
To litres, yeah. So you get 44, that's what, about 164, 170 litres. Within that context, though, you've actually got some production losses that actually occur. So
maybe 150 litres?
Possibly, yeah. I suppose my expertise is wholesale and retail and looking at commodity markets, so I can't give you an accurate answer to that one,
something
unfortunately.
Something like that. All right, Dave, in the mail truck, rather, is our final caller. Good day, Dave.
Good morning, Rod. How are you this morning?
Good, mate. What would you like to know?
Barrel of oil, mate. There's only 70 litres, I believe.
Okay, all right, 70 litres. Thank you.
No, but I sort of believe that the mining industry, it's all supply and demand. The mining industry is starting to revamp up again. Last time the mine started to had a bit of a boom session, the price of fuel went up.
Okay, good point.
Imaginably, and it's starting to do the same sort of thing again. I'm just wondering if that's sort of got something to do with it.
All right, good question. Thank you, Dave. All right, the mining industry, we went through that boom. They probably helped drive up the price of oil. Are they doing it again?
No, but I suppose there's an issue here in terms of our economy. We're a commodity-driven economy, so we produce a lot of raw products and sell it into the world. And oil, obviously, is a commodity as well, so other countries are actually doing it. So when global demand for commodities is high, so if the global economy is doing well, we're consuming more and more of these commodities, then what happens is the price of everything goes up, whether it's minerals or oil. But what tends to happen in those circumstances is your dollar goes up too, because more people want to buy your products. So we tend to go from settings where we get high return for the commodities and for the mining products that we actually produce, but that means we're then paying a higher price for the crude. But usually what happens is our dollar adjusts for that. To a low situation where you get a decline in the global economy and therefore the demand for these commodities drops off. So gold price, iron ore price, copper price and oil prices all drop. So you're getting a situation here where Australia as an economy tends to ride the highs and lows of commodity prices. So when mining does well, you generally find that the cost of crude oil goes up. When the demand for our mining products drops off, you find the cost of crude actually falls. And we're one of those economies that is exposed to that market.
All right. By the way, Yogi tells us it's 144 litres per barrel, so close to that 150 we guessed at.
Yep.
So thank you, Yogi. Thank you, Mark. We've all learnt so much this morning, and I think we've only touched the tip of the iceberg, and hopefully we'll do it again. I won't ask you to predict what oil prices or petrol prices will be like in a year.
Well, Rod, we've got about
5 seconds, Mark.
There's some good news. The price is starting to tail down a little bit in terms of crude. And I say to people, jump on the websites. The ACCC's got a great site on petrol price cycles, and the AIP, Australian Institute of Petroleum, gives you information about petrol price breakdown.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Thanks, Rod.
And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.